The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. And is the sound okay? People here? So, for this evening's talk, I'm going to... making amends, penance. a week ago or so, we had a big event here at IMC to celebrate the launch of our new retreat center we're buying. You see pictures of it in the wall outside. And we had a big dinner and we kind of launched our fundraising effort. And in the publicity, kind of announcing we were going to have this big event, this dinner and celebration, there was going to be a little talk by me, and we said that I was going to give a talk talking about my own experience of being on retreats, meditation retreats, my own kind of value and involvement with them. And then as we got to the time for me to give that talk, I completely forgot that was the topic. And we were celebrating this new big thing, and I thought we should talk about the new retreat center and celebrate it and talk about it. And I completely forgot about what I said I would talk about. And at the end, some person came up to me and said, "Gil." I think what he was saying, "Gil, you know, I came because of what it said." So I thought, uh-oh. So I thought, the first chance I get, I'm going to give that talk. Then you're it. So I would like to give a talk about my kind of history of my own involvement in retreats, meditation retreats. They have been a very important part of my life. I spent a considerable part of my adult life on long, silent retreats. And I feel like the important ways that I have been changed or grown in my life, or certainly in Buddhist practice, I attribute a lot to the experience of being on retreats. And not only have I been a practitioner on retreats, I've also now for about 20 years been a teacher on retreats. And in the last 20 years, I've actually taught many more retreats than I've actually participated as a student or in myself. But even the experience of being a teacher on retreat has been quite important for me and transformative for me in many ways. And so, much of my life has been connected, involved in these meditation retreats. And so, it might be interesting for some of you to hear about that history. I think that there were some experiences that I had growing up that were different. We're not sitting silent Buddhist retreats, but somehow touched on the same area that create a little bit of foundation or momentum that brought me into the world of meditation and into the world of retreats. Or when I started sitting retreats, they were kind of informed or inspired or were meaningful for me as I engaged in the retreats. One was my first experience of really deep silence, deep, peaceful silence, something that felt almost sacred. And that was maybe it was sacred, but that was, I was 18, and I was traveling around Europe by myself, and I came to a huge cathedral, monastery called Mont Saint-Michel. And if you've, it's kind of like, at least as I remember it now, kind of like this stereotypic Disney film animated palace that comes, rises out of a hill and spires up. And it's quite something. And I got a tour of this big cathedral. And as we went, it's built on a hill, and as we went around and saw the cathedral, the monastery, we climbed up the steps and came into the oldest building on the property. It was a chapel, a one-room stone chapel that, on top of the hill, that had been built, 1,200 years before, And the cathedral, the monastery had grown up around that small, simple stone chapel. And the cathedral and the monastery, you know, some of it was quite ornate and lavish, but that little chapel was intact, kind of embedded inside this big thing. And it had still the same, you know, rustic charm of cut stone, and it was pretty simple. And we walked into this building, into this one-room chapel, and when we did that, everything went silent for me. Everything got really still and peaceful. And I was just kind of, I was silenced by it. And I lingered as long as I could. There was a tour guide and they left and I stayed as long as I could just to sort of soak it in or experience it or be with it or something. And to have tasted that experience of silence that I never had before, that stillness or that peace, inspired me greatly. I didn't do much about it, but it remained kind of in the background for me, important. Then when I was 19, I had the fortune of working crewing on a sailboat that sailed across the Atlantic. Small sailboat, four people on board, before they had fancy equipment, autopilot and things like that. And I was kind of scared a little bit before going across the Atlantic. It was a big thing, right? A little sailboat. But to my surprise, the trip basically went peacefully, except for hurricane here and there. But it basically went peacefully. And and it was actually a very peaceful setting. It was going across day after day after day. It was very harmonious. They had these big swells that travel west. They had these low clouds dotted the sky, very low gray clouds that kind of also were kind of floating westward. We had the trade wind was blowing us westward. We had these amazing jellyfish in the water, lots of jellyfish in the water. I guess I had these like sails, jellyfish sails poking up. And they were sailing westwards. And we were going westward. Everything was kind of going in the same direction. And it was just an endless horizon for days and days on end. And we had to do watch. I would do a two-hour watch in the middle of the night. And it was quite something to be the only person awake in the middle of the Atlantic for, you know, hours and hours, you know, with just endless sky and stars and stillness. And every once in a while, maybe it only happened once, but that I got hit. But I was minding my own business, you know, at the helm. And so, only person, you know, awake. And middle Atlantic. And suddenly I got slugged in my right arm, my shoulder. Just boom, you know. Who slugged me? And they had these flying fish. And, you know, flying up, boom. And it was very peaceful, and somehow being connected to the water, to the clouds, to nature, and somehow I think being connected to the sailing of the boat, the attention that was required, the need to be in the present moment all the time when you're at the helm for 6 hours a day, we took turns. By the time we came across the other side, I was ecstatic, kind of this experience of rapture and ecstasy, and I just felt like I'd been changed dramatically by that experience. I never experienced such sustained joy and happiness. And in fact, it was so powerful for me that I told a friend, I'll never be depressed again. Only to get more depressed than I'd ever been 2 months later. So it didn't last. But again, that experience of stillness or of peace and joy and endless quiet space and the great dark sky and stars in the middle of the night was quite a powerful impact on me. That was when I was 18. That was 19. And then when I was 20, I went to live. I lived on a small dairy farm in Norway. And I spent, and the farmers left for a week and left me in charge of all these wonderful cows. And it was a very small cow, it had five cows and some calves. And I'd never been alone before in my life that way for a week. And the only person I saw in the distance for that week was a postman. And otherwise I didn't talk to anybody except for my girlfriends. Who didn't talk back in usual ways, these wonderful cows. And And I, it wasn't intentional that it was going to be silent, you know, solitary life. But in fact, you know, it was a solitary, silent life. And in the course of that week, my mind became more and more clear. And I became more sensitive, heightened sensitivity to the environment around me, to the nature around me and what was going on. And it was kind of like, it began to sparkle. And then, but even more impactful for me was, I got to see, I became more sensitive to my own thinking and my own inner life than I'd ever been before in my life. I became acutely sensitive to the movements of my mind and my heart, my emotions. And it just felt so precious to have this heightened sensitivity. And I don't remember being particularly peaceful or joyful, but it felt kind of very special and alive and wonderful. Alive was maybe kind of the feeling, vitality. And it felt so important that after my friends came back, it all went away. Because social life makes things more complicated. Life is a lot easier without people. And so then it impressed me so much that I made it my task to try to figure out how I can be alone together with people. Not to be aloof, but how could I have that intimacy and that clarity and sensitivity with people as well, so I didn't lose it, so the two could coexist. I didn't want to be a hermit. And then by that time I was interested in meditation, and so by the time I was 21, I started doing some Zen retreats. And the first retreat, so-called meditation retreat I did, was half a day. And that was, enough. And so I did a few of those, and then I thought, well, I'll try a day. So I did a day-long Zen retreat. And right now I can't remember back, any particular significance of that, except I remember the stillness, the silence of the room in the Zendo, the meditation hall, and sitting with other people in silence, that somehow that imprinted in my mind that I still remember in a palpable way, just sitting in that room with people and being so still in the room in a very beautifully clean way, this silence was. And then at some point, when I was 22, I believe, 22, I signed up for a 7-day Zen Sesshin. So the residential Sesshin, residential meditation retreat. And that's what we really usually think of meditation retreats being, is when you're in residence. You stay a place for multiple days, and you don't talk to anyone. You're in silence. Your full life is engaged in this meditative life. So it was 7 days. It was going to be 7 days. And about, I don't know how long, but a few weeks before the retreat, I called up the Zen Center and said to them, something really important has come up, and I'm not able to come to the retreat. And they said, okay, we'll take you off. They didn't ask, what's the important thing? Well, I didn't tell them, but the very important thing was fear. So I chickened out of my first meditation retreat. Isn't that nice? In case some of you are afraid about such things, I got over it. But so it took me about a year and a half before I finally signed up and actually did one of these 7-day Zen retreats. So when I was about, 23, 24, I sat one of these retreats. And this impressed me so much, that experience, that I went and moved to Green Gulf Zen Center a month later to be there and continue that life. And then in that year, I think I sat 3 of those sesshins at Green Gulch. And they were very important experiences for me. They were very difficult experiences, and meditation retreats can be quite difficult. There's a reason to be afraid of them. Because of the challenge. And the challenge is not necessarily the retreat, It's because or me, at least for me. So one of the things I learned right away, it kind of took me a while to really learn this, but those first 3, was that I had too many expectations of how great a meditator I was going to be. And so I was going to go and do this retreat, and I was going to get concentrated. And I was going to, all I had to do was, focus really well, and I'd get concentrated. And And I thought, you know, I'd been meditating every day, and every day I would get, you know, calm and settled in a nice, what I thought was a nice way. And I thought, well, just, I'll do, you know, I can do this. I'm doing well. I patted myself on the back. And I'll go do this Zen retreat, and, you know, it'll be great. But what I think happened was in my daily sitting, I shouldn't have taken credit for getting calm. I was just sitting quietly, doing nothing. And so most people get settled and calm and relaxed if you don't talk to anyone and sit quietly and still for 40 minutes. And so I was just unwinding. But if you go on a retreat, the unwinding happens pretty quickly. And you get to the end of the obvious unwinding. And then I had this extra kind of maybe ambition or greed or pushing or expectation or idea that I'm going to be this great concentrator. And so I was trying, but the way I was trying made it hard to get concentrated. So the solution was to try harder. And then it became, I would get even more agitated. So then, you know, I didn't know any better, so I just have to try harder and harder. And I was miserable. And I felt such despair and misery because I was such a failure and I couldn't do it. My mind was all over the place and didn't know what I was doing. And finally, it got so bad, I reached what I called rock bottom. And I gave up. I said to myself, it's hopeless. And when I said it was hopeless, that's when the retreat began. When I was no longer the one trying to do it and the one who was kind of caught up in selfing and getting someplace, but finally just gave up and was just there, not trying to get any place at all. And then I would start to develop some stillness, some concentration, some mindfulness of what was going on. As I developed, so in those early retreats, there were a few other things that happened, those first three. One was Zen is notoriously famous for sitting with pain. Because in Zen, you sit in a kind of very upright, strong posture, cross-legged posture, and you don't move for long, you know. And so I found myself sitting with a lot of, especially knee pain, and not moving with it. And because we weren't allowed to move in Zen, the only option was somehow to cope, to deal with it. And so I got to see my mind with great intimacy about all the reactivity I had. And the only way I was going to cope was somehow to be able to come to terms with my own mind and with my aversion, my resistance, my self-pity, and all the kind of movements of the mind that made it worse, all the second arrows that I added to it. And because I had so many hours and days of sitting there, I got to see this very clearly, and I got to work with it very clearly. And, you know, I couldn't escape it. It was so painful and difficult. And I'm glad I didn't escape. I'm glad I was up against that because I learned a lot about myself in it, that process. Another thing that was important in those early sesshins was because I was sitting with so much stillness and silence, you know, not many distractions, just sitting with myself, I got to see some of my psychological patterns, my emotional patterns in a way that I'd never seen before. Often in daily life, people are distracted from themselves. And they don't have the continuity to really see clearly how their mind operates. And I got to see how my mind suffered much more than I realized it did. How much guilt I was driven by. And there were times during the sesshin where I felt tremendous shame as well. There were times I would break down and cry and sob because of my shame and guilt that I felt that I was somehow bad and terrible and wrong. And so I got to see this and be with it. And what's beautiful about the Zen sesshins was the Zen center practice was I wasn't taught to do anything about it. And so I didn't occur to me you're supposed to do something about it. So I just got to sit there with my suffering and see it and be with it. And just being with it and seeing it, something softened. Something began to give and relax inside of me. And that was a very important to have the softening and relaxing and deepening that came just sitting with the difficulty. I see some people who struggle so much with their psychological difficulties that they have to fix it and do something, run away, close down. And they make it more complicated than it sometimes needs to be. Sometimes what needs to be is just to be with it, and be very simple. Just be there and let it change you. Let it open you in some way, and that efforts to do something about it get in the way of how it's going to practice you. So I had all these days and hours of sitting there and allowing this kind of transformational effect happen by just being present. And then another important part of these early retreats for me was the silence and the stillness. And in some ways, the sitting in a room of maybe 40, 50 people, these zendos, these big meditation halls, everyone completely still. And there's a stillness which is powerful, very, very strong. You can walk into a room like that from the outside, and people can be stunned by this, by the electric silence and stillness that's very rich and powerful. And I don't know why it is, why a group of people who sit in meditation can create this atmosphere that seems so palpably still and beautiful. If no one's there in a room, it's not as silent. It's not as still as people when their group of people are meditating well. And so sitting in this silence and this stillness felt to me like being sailing across the Atlantic and having all this space. It felt to me like sometimes like I was sitting in the midst of the vast, vast universe, and all was good. And to somehow let this good stillness, this safe stillness, this beautiful thing, silence and safety, that's this room. So it kind of came into my pores, it felt like. And it felt like just absorbing it somehow changed me, because it's still a palpable kinesthetic memory that I carry with me, all these hours and days of sitting this way. And then I decided to go off to a Zen monastery, Green Gulch is not quite a monastery, to do much longer intensive retreat time. And I didn't do it because I wanted to go deeper in meditation. I had no real ideas of going deeper. But what I wanted to do was to find, it was so important, the experience of integrity, authenticity that I felt in my meditation. I wanted to find a way to live that integrity in the rest of my life, the wider aspects of my life. And so I didn't know how to do that, but I thought if I go to the monastery where the whole life is informed by Buddhism and Buddhist practice, maybe I can get help in this very difficult task of bringing this integrity to the rest of my life as well. How I relate it to people and my work and all kinds of things. So I went to Tassajara, and the first thing you do when you're a new monk at Tassajara is sit you have to go through it kind of looks like a hazing. You have to, in this old medieval samurai way, you have to prove that you're sincere and worthy of entering the monastery. So you show up, and they put you directly into the meditation hall, and they tell you, you have to sit here at your seat without moving for 3 to 4 hours at a time, until it's time for a meal. Then you can turn around, and the meditation hall will feed you in the hall. And then you get a 30-minute break to go pee. And then you come back and you sit another 3-4 hours. And literally, you're not supposed to move for those 3 and 4 hours. You know, usually you can sit 40 minutes, but that was just, you're not supposed to move. And you're going to sit there for 5 to 10 days. And how long you sit depends on how well you sit. If you sit well, it'll be 5 days. But if you fidget a lot, it'll be 10 days. So there you were, sitting there. And there were three of us in this big room doing this thing, sitting there. And boy, was it painful. I don't recommend this, but, don't go home and do this. And mostly it was the knee pain again. And in order to cope, sometimes I would say to myself, I had two things, little mantras I would say. Sometimes I'd say, just moment after moment, just get to the next moment. And then sometimes I would tell myself, what if this is forever? And what if this was forever would help me somehow. It's like, what else can you do? But the thing that really helped, again, was to pay attention to my mind and notice the self-pity, the aversion, the clinging that came in. And I could see very clearly that when I reacted negatively to the pain, resisted it or contracted around it, the pain would get worse. And if I was really, really attentive, moment by moment, to how my mind reacted and responded to the pain, it would be okay to get through. And I felt amazingly, again, like I was in that farm in Norway, intimate, present. I felt like I got to see myself so well. Nothing, no thought, no movement passed by without being seen and known. And I felt like I knew myself so well during that time, such intimacy. And then at some point, kind of a little bit as a surprise, someone came and put their finger and tapped me on the shoulder. And as soon as I had a tapping on the shoulder, I knew, okay, it's over. I don't have to do it anymore. And I started crying. Or not crying, but, tearing. And the reason was that I felt I'll never be this intimate with myself again. And I felt it was going to be real. I felt sad, this loss, the loss of something really precious. Of course, eventually I did, but I just didn't know there was any other way until that. But it's possible to have this intimacy without sitting in pain, thankfully. So I did a few years at the Zen monastery, and they were very happy years for me, and for the most part. And then did more retreats there. And I started discovering in those Zen retreats at the monastery that my mind didn't always have to be operating. Maybe that doesn't come across well. Let's try to say it differently. That the intentional activity of the mind that always wants something, doesn't want something, and is thinking about things perceiving things, it's kind of the mind that moves all the time, very, very subtle. Even a peaceful mind can, be saying, talking to itself, visualizing things, engaged in something. It's about something. And I learned there that it's possible for the mind, the intentional mind, the volitional mind, the mind that always wants something, can come to rest. And it was really something to see it stop. See that volitional mind stop. It isn't like you disappear or something, but it was that was quite something. It kind of got my attention. It was something interesting. At some point, because of local problems with the local abbot and the scandals, ethical scandals, things like that, I ended up going to practice in Japan and did sesshins, Zen retreats there. But they didn't really have much impact on me. I did. Some of them were kind of fun or interesting because you do these you go into these intense training monasteries that are kind of walled off from the city, other places, and it's literally like it was literally like stepping back to the 1500s, 1300s. Things that life hadn't changed in the monastery hardly at all, and the routine, the schedule, the clothes, the food, the utensils you used. It was quite a trip, kind of fun, to go back a few hundred years. It's like it's like suddenly they gave you pilgrim clothes. you had these clothes were all, the clothes, these Zen clothes are these are as old as older than the pilgrim clothes. So it's kind of like Japanese think it's kind of bizarre. We think it's kind of cool because it's Zen, right? But Japanese look at these Zen robes and wow, pilgrims. but it was fun, but that was, I don't remember so much. I mean, that's significant. But what happened during that year in Japan, I went to Thailand to get a new visa. And when I was in Thailand waiting for my visa, I went to check out a local Vipassana center, monastery. And I showed up, basically said to the abbot, I'm here, what do I do? And he gave me a little hut at the edge of the monastery, and he gave me a schedule. You used to do sitting meditation, walking meditation, and come back and see me tomorrow. That's all I was supposed to do. And so I walked and sat and walked and sat and did it, and I came back and saw him the next day, and every day I saw him. And I ended up sitting a 10-week silent meditation retreat. My introduction to Vipassana was a 10-week retreat. So that's long enough to get your attention. It's a little different than just doing a 5-week introductory course. But the biggest impact of that 10 weeks was not the Vipassana instruction that I got, but rather was sitting in silence for 10 weeks, being in meditation for 10 weeks. I touched two things that were very important. One was I experienced a level of inner purity that I'd never known before. And that was the words I used for me, was inner purity. And it was so beautiful. And until then, I thought the words like purity were kind of like, and being ethical was all like for goody-goodies. I didn't think, I was basically an ethical person, but not because I intended to, maybe out of lack of imagination. But to discover this incredibly beautiful thing, purity, was it really stunned me. It got my attention, and it got my interest in ethics and pure and precepts in a way that I hadn't been interested in before. And the second thing was that I don't have a particularly good natural capacity for concentration, but the 10 weeks was long enough for me to get more concentrated than I ever had been before. And I touched a degree of inner concentration, inner stillness, that I had never touched before, even in the Zen retreats. And in the quietest place I came to, I felt something that felt very important. It was like a little seed or kernel of a self. And I didn't feel like it was bad, but it became essential, like a biological imperative. Like it was not like I had any choice about it. I had to go and touch that place again. I had to get there again. And I went back to Japan, and the Zen practice and the Zen retreats just didn't help me go back there. And I was kind of disappointed at that point in the opportunities for practice in Japan. So the first chance I had, I went back to Asia to get this experience, to touch that place again. And it was kind of like a dark night of the soul time for me, because it took me about a year to get back on retreat. And nothing else mattered. Nothing in my life, nothing mattered at all for me except to go and touch that again. And I went back to Asia the second time. And I went back, literally my intention was to go back for the duration, for however long it took. I'm not sure what it was, but I was going to. That's what I was going to do. And nothing else had any meaning for me, because I just had to somehow touch something, transform something, do something. And I call it a biological imperative. It wasn't intentional exactly in terms of, it wasn't logical, it wasn't thought out. And so then I went back and sat a few retreats. But then the retreat that really was meaningful was I sat with, in Burma, an 8-month silent Vipassana retreat. So like an 8-month session. It was like just all, I would meditate something like 15, 16 hours a day, and between sitting meditation and walking meditation, usually an hour of each, back and forth. And once a day, I usually had an interview with a teacher for 10 minutes, and most days there was a Dharma talk. But otherwise, there was no work, no jobs, no yogi jobs, like we have in our retreats. It took me about 4 months before I got around to cleaning my room. And I had to wash my clothes, and so I wouldn't have to take it away from my meditation. We had these big buckets in Burma, these buckets. I didn't have a bucket. I brought a bucket with me. Somehow I realized I should buy a bucket in Thailand, so I carried it on the plane, plastic bucket. And I had this little, coils, electrical coils that you will heat tea water in a cup? You plug it in the wall. So I had bought one of those too. So I would fill the bucket with water and put the electrical coil into the water and then go back and meditate. And after my meditation, the water would be hot. And then I would put my clothes in the water and go back and meditate. And then when I finished meditating that session, I'd take the clothes and hang them up. That was laundry. Let's make it as simple as I could. And I would say that for about 4 of those 8 months, were the happiest times of my life. I was alone, mostly. I meditated in my room by myself, did my walking alone, so I spent hours and hours alone. But the degree to which I settled, let go of my complexes and my neurosis and my concerns, the degree to which I was fully present in this life right here, moment by moment, the degree I was concentrated and still, and there was this beautiful feeling. And this idea of silence and stillness has always been very important for me. Sometimes in these long, long hours of sitting there in Burma, I had the sense that my eyes closed. Sometimes I had a sense that I was peering, staring deep into the vast universe. You know, like it's Hubble photographs, you know, just like endless, you know, black and stars. And somehow I was staring into it, and it was just incredibly beautiful. It felt like home. It felt like here I was at home in the world. As I continued sitting and getting concentrated and learning the mindfulness practice, I had to meld the Zen practice I did with the Vipassana. And the way it worked was Zen for me was practicing unconditional acceptance of the present moment and just being there with what is. And what Vipassana taught me was to do that thoroughly. That I started to see through Vipassana, the practice and the teachings, that the mind works very fast and very subtly. And so there were a lot of different... So I could have a generic, general feeling that I was present and calm and empty and, you know, accepting of the moment, but not really. You know, in the cracks, in the subtle microscopic cracks, there was all this non-acceptance, all this reactivity, all this selfing going on. And I got to see the details in a way I'd never seen in Zen, which was more, for me, was more the macro. This was the micro. And so Vipassana taught me how to get much more thorough in this acceptance thing. And as I did that, I got stiller and stiller and stiller, quieter and quieter and happier, and tremendous experience of joy and well-being. And it's quite something to sit for months on end, saturated with well-being, just feeling well-being kind of going through you. And as that experience deepened, then a deeper and deeper experience of equanimity and peace that I experienced, until something gave away, something let go that I'd never experienced before. And that something which let go changed who I was, changed my relationship to myself, to the world, my understanding of what it's all about here. And that thing that I had to touch, that kernel of self, that no longer became an issue. It was no longer that, you know, there was no longer a kernel. And it was only then that I began having this idea, you know, this is good stuff. I think I want to teach this stuff. I came back and continued doing some retreats here and had similar kind of deep experiences. And then I was asked by Jack Kornfield, invited to join teacher training in 1989. And then I started teaching retreats by a couple of years later. And one of the, I clearly wanted to teach because I had benefited so incredibly much from retreats and meditation practice. And first I thought I wanted to just be a retreat teacher. That's all I wanted to do, because that's, you know. And I was very grateful that I ended up not being only a retreat teacher, but ending up in Palo Alto as a sitting group and developing a community like what we have here now. Because I learned that practice is much more than being on retreat. It's very powerful and meaningful to practice in all aspects of our life. But still, I taught many retreats, and one of the benefits for me, a lot of benefits, you know, when I teach retreats, I'm on retreat too. So that's good. But what I learned was, I learned a lot from the students that I had. I learned that people's experience of life can be quite different than my own. And I kind of had thought that many people had the same kind of life as I had. And I remember taking, I took a 1983 or something, I did a Stephen Levine workshop. I was interested in, I read his book, Who Dies, and was moved by it. And I thought I'd take a workshop, weekend workshop by him. And And I went to the workshop, and before people started, I looked around, and there were ordinary people there. You know, those are ordinary people, like you'd see anywhere, something like that. And then they started speaking during the workshop. It was a workshop on, you know, death and dying. And they had, you know, some of them were dying close to death. Some of them had just lost their child. Some of them lost, you know, their loved ones. And there was, I couldn't believe it, because they were ordinary people. I didn't know that ordinary people had death in their lives. And it kind of, that kind of, I realized from that workshop that I can't assume that I know people, because I see them, you know, from the outside. And as I was a teacher, I got to encounter people in so many different aspects of human life, in the full range of human experience, human drama, human tragedy, human joys. And you're to do that, you know, day after day on retreats, teaching and meeting people and meeting, you know, you have to be changed by that as a teacher. And I felt changed by it. I felt like I learned a lot about human life. I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about compassion. I learned, I felt like I've been changed and grown and matured so much by the encounter with the challenges that so many people have in this life. So much so that I think that no one should be allowed to teach until they've taught for 20 years. So I don't know how we get over that issue, but, you know, you have to give people a chance to, you know, teach so they can be qualified. That's the way it works, but we do the best we can. And by being a teacher, I know that I was deeply affected and transformed and healed and purified and liberated from being on retreats and practicing. But as a teacher, I've seen how other people have gone through the same thing. And I've seen how incredibly powerful it is for people to do these silent retreats. It's not uncommon for therapists who come on retreats or have clients go on retreats or people who have been in therapy and say, a 10-day silent Vipassana retreat is like a year of therapy, because of how deep the insight, the understanding, the self-confrontation is. And the way in which we learn about ourselves, the way we meet ourselves, the way we see aspects of our life that we can often not see, the way that we open up and free ourselves. And I've, you know, it's just so beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful things that I know. I wish you could all be teachers so you could see, you know, what, you know, the other side, or see, you know, how significant impact this has on the world, I think, on individuals. And as individuals go out into the world, I think we become agents of peace, of well-being, of compassion for the rest of the world through that transformation. It's not easy to do these meditation retreats. Being afraid is a reasonable thing. If you're new, if never been on one, maybe I would worry a little bit if you weren't a little bit afraid. But it's one of the most beautiful, meaningful things that anyone can do, I feel. And I've dedicated my life to try to provide this opportunities for people to do this, support people in that process. And it's my hope that many, many people, at least once in their life, but probably two or three times, because sometimes it takes two or three times to really get a sense of what's going on, have a chance to do a silent retreat. And I hope in that process that you will come back out of the retreat and be able to benefit many other people. So thank you. I hope it was okay to spend 45 minutes talking about myself. I was kind of somewhat reluctant to do it, but I had to make amends. So, thank you.